The Driftless by Matthew F. Armstrong. Part 1.
Chapter 1. Grant threw his weight against the aluminum crash bar and forced open the heavy steel door to stick out his head and look down the street. Under the lamplights, he could see the little band of campaign volunteers trotting east to join their friends at the Dark Horse Tavern. Or maybe they'd camp out at some place on Greenfield Avenue, stamping their feet and smoking cigarettes against the chill before tanking up on beers and then stumbling home. He watched them turn onto Orchard Street and disappear, and as he turned to duck back inside, his eye caught the illuminated face of the enormous clock tower. It was nicknamed the Polish Moon, and had stood stoically for 70 years watching over the collection of dilapidated warehouses, factories, and worker homesteads on the south side of Milwaukee. Ulysses Grant Jablonski was 41 years old and currently overweight through no fault of his own, save for a relentless drinking and drug habit that came and went like the seasons. No one called him by his first name, and he only grudgingly included it on any tax forms or official documentation. He wasn't exactly ashamed of a ponderous name like Ulysses, for as a literary man, he understood the importance of Homer and Joyce. But as a guy who liked to drink and fight, he also understood the importance of the Civil War, and for that he much preferred to use his middle name. Regarding Jablonski, that was a leftover from his father's side. He generally tried to avoid thinking about it. He sat down in a wheeled desk chair he had plucked from one of the upper management offices and rolled across the cracked cement floor, enjoying the loud rumble that echoed through the old shuttered factory. It had been requisitioned by the Bradley Cunningham campaign for governor, of which Grant was the director of communications. He and his staff of three organized mailing drives, contacted news outlets, and coordinated volunteers to canvass and blockwalk leading up to the November general election. He was, by his own admission, more or less of a hack, but suffered no shame about it. He was happy to be a simple shiv in the ongoing struggle for justice. So it was when the day's work had wound down and Grant had finished cleaning up a litter of coffee cups and cellophane cheese Danish wrappers off his desk that he found himself alone again. He liked to stay late and close up shop, busying himself with the copy editing or listening to the nighttime Brewer games. He would finish up by emailing other managers at various levels in the campaign and then mutter a few righteous curses as he straightened up the large common area shared by the staffers. Placards and single-page flyers, folded handouts, slick campaign banners were all stacked haphazardly in aluminum janitorial carts, and a beat-up orange couch sat lump-like amid folding tables covered with comic books featuring impossible heroes battling grotesque creatures menacing the world. In another 30 minutes, he had packed up his bag, pulled on a shapeless overcoat, and flicked off the buzzy sodium lights on his way out the door. The lowing of a foghorn guarding the pierhead greeted him as he walked to his car underneath the lantern light of the clock tower, and he felt a familiar melancholy. After climbing into his car, he slouched down in his seat and allowed the depression that formed after Cassie had passed to settle over him like a familiar blanket. He had met her when he stepped into a tavern for a quick one while block walking. She was tending bar, and by the end of the afternoon he had fallen in love. She had the wry wit of the perennial disappointed, combined with the bubbling energy of a teenager discovering a cuss word. They'd bonded after a couple nights of scotch and cocaine, and when she moved in, they had a frantic series of squabbles and makeups. Grant felt he had to keep watch over this particularly self-destructive woman. She was a brilliant writer, who occasionally freelanced for the journal, and through her, Grant had entered parts of the city's artistic scene that he normally would have scoffed at as a collection of effete and self-congratulating snobs. Her life was like his. Both were half-breeds of European and Hispanic stock estranged from their families. They related to one another as mirrored opposites, her with Gothic sensibilities and a brutal cynicism, him with a wardrobe from Sears and a tragic devotion to Milwaukee's demised unions. Neither had much use for sentiment, but at least for Grant, Cassie offered a glimmer of hope for a certain stability and eventual reconciliation with whatever life might put in front of them. Unfortunately, Cassie had recently died in a car accident that was as much on purpose as everything else she did to ruin her life. Grant reached his apartment and pulled over to the curb. He had rented the top floor of a two-story clapboard house on 928 Land Street for the last several years. It was only about a half mile north of the campaign headquarters, and it was exactly 46 steps to Scavuto's, the tavern on the corner. Scavuto's was a home to longtime locals, including several of Grant's distant cousins. He had spent his whole life shuttling around Milwaukee's central and southern neighborhoods, so for him, spending time at the tavern was like belonging to a country club where the membership was based on where you had your first factory job. Grant and Cassie holed up there for over a year after meeting, and as he trudged up the back stairs and struggled with the deadbolt, he still had to remind himself that she wasn't here anymore. He took off his coat and draped it on one of the chairs circling the kitchen table, then crossed through an adjacent hallway to the living room where he collapsed on an old, overstuffed couch. The room was small, with worn wooden floors and a potted fern hanging from one of the windows facing Land Street. There used to be a glass coffee table that he and Cassie had bought together at a second-hand store, but Grant destroyed it in a rage the night she disappeared. When he found out the following afternoon that she was involved in an accident, he'd already cleaned up and thrown away the shards and broken frame. The night was early by Grant's reckoning. He always had a few beers down at the tavern before heading home to bed around midnight, but in the last week since her death, Grant had stayed in, preferring to drink packaged beer all night and red tops of vodka to go with a pint of orange juice when he reported to work in the morning. What he hadn't done was any coke, but that's what he was thinking about as he turned on the television. The face of Bradley Cunningham, candidate for governor, suddenly was glowing in front of him. Cunningham was a cipher who Grant detested, but figured skewed left enough for him to do his job without feeling too shitty about it. A scion of a family out of Whitefish Bay and a graduate of Nicolet High School in Marquette, Cunningham was a lawyer second and a politician first. To Grant, this meant he had a chance to revive the public sector spirits necessary to drive turnout in the remaining union classes and rural archetypes forever grousing about Milwaukee grifters, while at the same time possessing the elite credentials necessary to keep the suburban counties from conclusively mobilizing against him. Beyond that, Grant didn't think too much about Bradley Cunningham. His eyes drifted from the television and landed near his feet, where he saw a trail of tiny ants traveling back and forth between his couch and some far-off crack in the floor. He and Cassie fought valiantly against these minor infestations, but now he relished the company. They formed lines of moving black dots that weaved along their own internal frequency, and Grant watched with an engrossed fascination as they disappeared underneath him and then reappeared carrying bits of food. He found himself remembering his fourth-grade teacher explaining how ants could communicate almost telepathically via their keen sense of smell. They were thus able to operate as one entity, all moving in unison to solve whatever problems needed attention. Superorganism. That was the word she used. Despite the obvious sense of purpose, if that's what it meant to be part of a hive, then Grant did not necessarily want to be an ant. "Better you than me, buddy," he said, and snapped off the television. He had decided to visit Scavuto's after all.
Chapter 2. Scavuto's was still a working man's bar. It was usually packed when the second shift ended, and it was only last year that they stopped being open first thing in the morning for third shift guys getting off work. It was Friday night, and weekends brought out college hipsters hoping to buy a drink for Laverne and Shirley. Grant arrived at the tavern around 10 o'clock and was waved inside by a bored bouncer checking IDs. He and Cassie liked to come by in the afternoon when one of the bartenders they knew would open up and they'd have the place to themselves. Tonight it was Jim, a skinny old crank who was mostly sober except for during Brewer games when he'd allow himself a shot and a beer if they were going up into the eighth inning. This season the team was only a few weeks away from October baseball, so he was serenading the busy bar in his crackling lyric baritone as he delivered Grant a beer. Around him were middle-aged guys playing pool and competing in dart leagues with their wives, who were massaging cocktails while sitting in lined-up folding chairs. Scavuto's had two pool tables, both in fine condition, and enough room by the jukebox to allow patrons to mingle and grind. A pair of immensely strong hands suddenly laid themselves on Grant's shoulders and squeezed his neck, causing him to spill his beer down the front of his shirt. He swore, but then the hands relaxed, and a wiry man who looked about in his 30s sat down on the stool next to him. Upon closer inspection, someone might see the man was actually in his 50s, and it still shocked Grant every time he saw his cousin Dale's permanently youthful and befuddled expressions. Dale leaned jauntily against the bar and leveled a finger at Grant. "Hey, what's your name, buddy?" he said, with a manic grin spreading across his face. "Nobody," Grant said, wiping the spilled beer from his shirt. Dale brayed and clapped Grant hard on the shoulder again. "That's my favorite line, you know?" "Yeah, man, I know. You doing all right? First time I've seen you here in the longest," said Dale, now fully sitting on the bar and waving to Jim. "Well, I guess it was about time," said Grant. "I can't really avoid this place." "You're telling me," said Dale. "Too bad that includes all my ex-girlfriends." Dale laughed again, before his face clouded over quickly like a child recognizing he'd been tricked. "Sorry, buddy. I shouldn't have said that." "It's okay. I just figured I should come out and maybe socialize," said Grant. "Yeah, man.
That's exactly the thing to do. Suddenly, he leaned in close to Grant and then turned his head from side to side to scan the busy bar. Hey, it's Friday night. You want some bump? Dale whispered. Grant wasn't sure about the choice he was about to make, but eventually he nodded and gave Dale a weak smile. Right. Wait here, whispered Dale furiously, before pulling himself away from Grant and disappearing into the crowded bar. Grant gazed at the soft yellow backlighting of the fading Old Milwaukee signs and bags of pretzels that were pinned up the sides of the cash register like Christmas stockings. His whole family had made their way through places like these on their way back to tenement apartments and small shotgun houses built next to the factories up and down the waterfront. They were labor through and through, with Grant's dad serving as a union organizer during the meatpacking strikes in the 70s. One morning, the police found him stuffed inside a storm culvert when they were tearing up Meyer Airport to make way for downtown. Grant was finishing up his beer when he smelled a wave of delicate fragrance that made him think of chrysanthemums and buttery leather. He felt a familiar bulk fill the stool that Dale had vacated and looked to his right to see a woman with blonde hair and heavily made-up eyes ordering a drink from Jim. A flush of embarrassment rolled over him as he caught himself looking her up and down. She was sure to have noticed because Jeanette was a cop. "So, you're feeling better," said Jeanette, now deliberately turning to face him and presenting a display of décolletage that made Grant involuntarily adjust his weight on his stool. Jeanette laughed and turned to rest her elbow on the bar as she reviewed a dark cocktail from Jim. "It's about time you made an effort, at least." Grant didn't know how to respond. Jeanette was an ex-something, the two of them having slept together in the past as random hookups and then again as something else. When Grant told her about meeting Cassie, Jeanette looked relieved. Still, there was a tenderness between them. She was a county cop who did a few years on a drug task force and then switched over to working with communities. Part of her job was working with hospitals who had bodies in their morgues that no one claimed and of which no next of kin could be found. She'd go out and track down anyone who could be notified before the hospital shipped off the corpse to be incinerated. Grant was at home wondering if Cassie would ever come back when Jeanette showed up with another officer and told him she was dead. She had crashed her car, his car, into an iron girder holding up Interstate 94. She told the other officer to wait in the squad car when Grant collapsed in front of them. She held him and smoothed his hair and told him it wasn't his fault, even though she knew Grant wouldn't believe her. "How's the campaign?" she said. "Things are looking up for the good guys." "Yeah, okay, you keep saying that," she said, now facing the bar. Grant took in her profile and let his eyes trace the thick cheekbones that framed a mouth that was too big for her face. She had a blonde rinse and had only recently let her hair grow out longer than the sharp angled bob she wore when they first met. Tonight she had it pinned up to reveal a rather delicate silk red halter top framing a strong neck and shoulders. Grant didn't think of Jeanette as a large woman, but the strength of her German-Polish body impressed upon him a certain capability and pragmatism. He supposed she looked out of place with such a deliberately delicate outfit amidst the Carhartt jackets and blue jeans of the little neighborhood bar, but he knew better. Jeanette came from the Lower East Side and knew more about the people wandering in and out of these taverns than he did. They traded stories about their jobs and asked about each other's families. Jeanette was seeing a guy, but when pressed, she shifted into a cagey aloofness which reminded Grant of how hard it must be to be married to a cop. Jeanette asked about Cassie's family, but Grant didn't have much to say. He'd spoken with an uncle a couple of days after her death, but the silence on the other end of the line made it impossible to tell if his message had made it any further. Grant paid for the incineration, but didn't keep any ashes. He figured Cassie couldn't have cared less. They kept drinking, and after a while, Jeanette politely excused herself and disappeared to the ladies' room. Soon after, Dale pushed his way in from the crowd and hopped up on the stool. "Okay, bump it up." "Jeanette's sitting there," said Grant. "Aw, man, she's here again," groused Dale. "How come a cop always has to hang around on Friday nights when everyone's trying to have some fun? Here, special delivery." Dale thrust a small Ziploc bag into Grant's open palm, and he instinctively retracted his arm into the pocket of his khakis. "That's good stuff," whispered Dale, leaning in to make sure he could hear him. Grant caught sight of Dale's back teeth and winced at the obvious decay. Dale had been doing coke for a long time, but managed to hold down a job being a delivery driver for a uniform company, which paid him enough to keep the taxes paid on his deceased parents' house. While the drug use had kicked into high gear after his divorce, in the last few years, Dale had turned a corner since his company started random drug testing. He had an administrative connection that told him when the tests were coming in exchange for a couple bumps. When he had to flush his system for 2 weeks prior to going to the test, He just figured it was sort of like a Weight Watchers for blow. Grant wanted to feel bad for him, but he didn't want to be a snob about it. He put a lot of faith in the virtue of the working classes. He held fast to memories of attending union meetings with his dad and sitting in the back seat of his uncle's Thunderbird while men broke up protests from opposition groups outside the labor halls with bottles and fists. One of the last images of his father was him striding confidently up and down the strike line in front of the Cudahy plant when Grant was about 10. He remembered a tall figure with immense shoulders and a black watchman's cap, brandishing a bullhorn and exhorting the members. He could still see the puffs of exhale on the frigid winter air, creating halos around the union brothers and sisters parading intently in front of the factory. That was all gone now, but people like Dale remained, and Grant felt an obligation to at least entertain his weaknesses as simple trade-offs, like he did with a lot of the things in his own life. "That's my seat, Dale." "Ah, gee, sorry, Jeanette," said Dale. "That's a beautiful top. Why don't you go throw some darts?" Jeanette retook the stool, and when Dale had drifted away from the bar, she gently lifted the napkin from the top of her drink and took a sip. "So, you're holding now," she said, not bothering to look over at Grant. "Nah." Now she turned and leveled her eyes at him. "Okay," muttered Grant. He reluctantly dug into his pocket and slid the packet of cocaine over to her. "What am I supposed to do with this?" "I don't know." "Christ, you're a mess. This is the last thing you need." They sat in silence for another moment. "You should go home now," said Jeanette. "You want to go with me?" said Grant lamely. Jeanette turned to him and smiled a look of exquisite pity. "That is a terrible idea. But if you want, I will walk you back," she said. Grant felt better. "Okay, but let's get one more," he said. "It'll be safer than taking sleeping pills." Jeanette snorted and waved to Jim for another round. The two of them talked some more and drank another round after that. Then Jeanette helped Grant get back to his front door, where she gave him a polite but warm hug goodbye. Grant couldn't help but let his head rest heavily on her broad shoulder. She shook him to attention and spun him around to give him a push towards his door. "Go to bed, Grant," she said, giving him a light kiss on his cheek. Upstairs in his apartment, he collapsed on the foot of his bed and stared down at the floor through the dim light coming from the kitchen. He blinked and a few tears rolled down his nose and onto the floorboards. He reached up to wipe his snot and ended up sliding forward onto his head. He grunted and attempted to right himself, but couldn't get the muscle control together, so he gave up and was about to let himself collapse when he saw what looked like a small box hidden in a deep corner under the bed. He had just thought to reach for it when his legs flipped over and drove his face into the wooden plank. He forgot about the box and instead passed out on the floor, where his snoring eventually rang out through the dark apartment and then down the stairs and into the crisp night. Chapter 3. Grant woke up thinking about the box. He thought he had successfully gotten rid of everything touched by Cassie, save the bedclothes, but perhaps he had missed something. He got out of bed and flattened himself against the cool of the floorboard to peer into the dark underneath the bed. He saw the small box sitting there and managed to get his meaty fingers around it and slide it towards him. He grunted as he hauled himself up off the floor and plopped down on the edge of the bed. The curious box was made of some ancient-looking wood and had a series of delicately carved roses intertwined around its edge, with a tarnished brass lid and a small keyhole. Grant tried to pry it open with his fingers, but it wouldn't give. He thought for a moment, and an idea spurred him off the bed and over to his dresser's top drawer. When Jeanette had come to tell him about Cassie, she gave him items collected off the body, a bracelet that he had bought her during a booze-soaked trip to Tijuana, a pair of earrings she said she got from her mother, and a delicate silver chain necklace with tiny charms of a heart and a unicorn, which he now noticed also held a small carved brass key. He took the key, and with a tremble in his hand, he returned to the bed. Inserting the key into the box, he turned it gently and heard the tumblers roll over and the lid sprung open. Inside was a small pile of yellow papers, possibly letters, along with a small brown leather notebook with worn edges. He displayed the contents of the box on the bedspread and suddenly felt hot. He stripped off the white tube socks he had left on from the previous night and crossed to the wall switch where he turned on the overhead fan. When he turned back, he cursed aloud as he saw the breeze had blown away the papers, and after a minute gathering up the letters, he returned to the bed and placed them back in the box. When he reached for the worn notebook lying on top of his pillow, it occurred to him that he hadn't left it there before turning on the fan. He imagined it was entirely possible he knocked it up to the head of the bed when he got up. He brought the little book onto his lap, and upon closer inspection, he could make out three faintly embossed letters on the front cover, A.G.D. This didn't mean anything to Grant, but he was obviously holding someone's personal diary. He gingerly opened the brittle leather cover and read in the black ink scrawl lining the top of the page. Personal property of Arthur G. Derry, 234 South River Street, Sauk Prairie, Wisconsin. Underneath this was a short note, this one recognizably newer as it was written in blue ballpoint ink. For Cassie, from Daddy. Grant had never seen this book before, and he couldn't remember ever seeing the small box either. How could he have missed this when cleaning out Cassie's things? He supposed he'd find still more items stuffed in corners around the apartment, and took a shaky breath before placing the book back into the box. Then he had to pee. In the bathroom was a beat-up toothbrush and a half-squeezed-out bottle of toothpaste, along with an old washcloth. He cleaned up and ran a comb through his hair, and then regarded himself in the mirror. He looked old again today, and then remembered last night at the tavern. He flushed when thinking of Jeanette walking him home like some sort of juvenile truant, but further down, he was ashamed at his relief that she still cared for him. He blew out his nose in a ball of toilet paper and snapped off the light. He had to go into work to straighten out what the next week would require. A post-Labor Day push for the polls was the usual play. He was told that Cunningham would be able to hustle a few more checks in from a fundraiser they were holding tomorrow, but as of right now, they were almost out of money. There was an upcoming speech at the Harley-Davidson Museum, and it was Grant's job to figure out a way to get some publicity. It wasn't necessarily a good fit for Cunningham. His Whitefish Bay credentials wouldn't play well there, but he liked to flaunt his pro-boner labor bona fides. What Grant knew was that it wasn't going to be enough. None of it would be. The only folks who gave a shit about supporting unions were whoever was left in leadership still pulling in dues from the higher-skilled guys, and Grant knew that the old-time Poles and Germans encircling Milwaukee associated public sector unions with handouts to minorities they thought were clogging up the civil service ranks. Although he knew it was a lost cause when he took the gig, Grant figured he needed the work to keep the wheels from falling off his political career completely, so he signed up and dug in. About 20 minutes later, he arrived at the factory and sat down at his desk and waited for the computer to fire up. He felt a vibration under his left butt cheek and dug down in his back pocket to fish out his phone. The number only looked vaguely familiar. "This is Grant." "Hey, Grant. It's John Strasser. You okay, buddy? I heard about Cassie. I am terribly sorry." Grant closed his eyes and steeled himself to respond. Strasser was an old buddy of Cassie's who sometimes gave her work as a stringer. Grant thought he was a tool, but figured at least he'd helped out Cassie when she was successfully staying out of rehab. "Yeah, I'm functional," he said, making his voice flat, if not steady. "Well, this might be insensitive, but I thought of something this morning. I'm not sure if you knew that Cassie was looking at doing an assignment for me." He went on to explain that one of his clients, a media conglomerate that operated a number of outdoor magazine titles, was looking for a writer to do a piece on outdoor recreation options around the upwardly mobile city of Madison. And he had lined up Cassie to do something on the Wisconsin River, and now John was afraid that might not happen. Grant paused to consider. Cassie hadn't said anything about a trip on a river, but her life had been filled with jack-in-the-boxes. Sitting next to him on the desk was his wallet, which, while resembling a smaller-sized ham, actually did not represent any money. It was stuffed with maxed-out credit cards along with his driver's license and an expired health insurance card. "How much?" he said. $2,000 for 2,000 words and pictures. Can you handle at least a cell phone camera? Or send us some stock photos of the area and we'll take care of it." Grant accepted and hung up. He wondered how he'd duck out of his responsibilities for the week, but just then the iron door clanged open and he spun upon his chair to see Corinne enter. She was his best, most pliable volunteer, and while normally he'd have to grit his teeth at her incessant joie de vivre, today she gave him her bright smile and he returned it with his own snaggly grin. She went over to her desk where she began to struggle out of her oversized jacket, ultimately snagging her sleeve on the arm of her desk chair, and she had to twist her body around in a full rotation to free herself. Grant watched as she eventually gave up, slowly sinking to the floor and raising the coat and chair over her head in order to extract her arms from her coat sleeves. She popped back up with a bright smile and giggling self-consciously while standing her chair up and rearranging her desk. "Hey, Corinne," said Grant. "I need a favor." When he got home, he went straight to his bedroom and opened up the box that he had left on his nightstand. Inside was the journal and underneath were the papers. He carefully arranged everything on top of the bedspread again and turned over the yellowed pages. Most turned out to be newspaper clippings, with one reading, "Local residents still missing, two men feared dead." Others went on to detail the disappearance of ostensible journal owner Arthur G. Derry, along with his friend Reginald Sykes. Both were from Sauk Prairie, which was a small hamlet located on the bend of the Wisconsin River, about 90 minutes from the city. Grant looked at the dates and saw they were mostly from October of 1952, until the last one referenced Cassie's father, Terry McTiernan, who died in 1991. His name was highlighted in yellow marker near the bottom of the obituary column in a cutout section of the Milwaukee Journal. Another was from a smaller paper, the Milwaukee People's Press, that Grant knew had closed down when it was bought out by the Journal. There was a small, fuzzy picture of Terry inset against a larger photo of a factory. The headline read, "Worker Dies in Mysterious Accident." Grant knew the rest. Cassie's father had gotten pinned between two heavy-gauge steel tanks when working a shift at a local fabrication plant. Something about an accident with the remote control, and he got crushed and died of a blood clot in his femoral artery 2 days later. The company fought it by maintaining there were sufficient warnings in the manuals, but at least Cassie's mom got something of a settlement. There wasn't any pension since it was a non-union job, and Grant couldn't help but wonder about that since her dad was an organizer too, even though by the time he had graduated high school, most plants had closed and left. The way Cassie told it, the settlement was enough to get her into college, but not out since her mom ended up drinking the rest. Grant winced as he felt the beginnings of a headache. Where was he going to go to write this story? He never went camping in his life, except for passing out in a cabin when he went ice fishing with his cousins. He spent a couple years in Boy Scouts, but the camping wasn't much more than setting up a tent at the fairgrounds and walking through Kettle Moraine State Park to look at glacier formations. He for sure didn't know a thing about boats on rivers. He gathered up the papers and stuffed them back into the little box and shut the lid. That left the brown leather journal lying innocuously on the bed. He folded back the cover and looked at the inscription again. Cassie's mom must have collected those newspaper clippings and passed them on to Cassie, or Cassie just found them. Either way, together they rounded out what he already knew. She'd had a shitty life, and the scars to prove it. He wondered why he was surprised that she died so suddenly. It wasn't like death had been a stranger to her, or to him. He felt foolish for all the years spent circling around her, attempting to distract her from the darkness she said was her birthright. She claimed she was a direct descendant of hopeless causes. Then she'd smile a crooked and lopsided grin and laugh, making her jet-black bangs shake like the branches of a willow tree. "Poor Ulysses, you don't gotta go home, but you can't stay here." She would say that when they got drunk. It underlined her restlessness. He could tell when her rages were beginning to boil, and Grant would take that line as his cue to make sure that the tab was paid up. He turned the page to see the beginning of a carefully scripted journal and read on. June 23rd, 1952. "This afternoon I spoke with LTD by telephone. He had only recently been released from the hospital and was currently staying in his aunt's apartment while she was on holiday in London. It was fortunate for him that she was gone. I'm not quite sure what would have happened to him if it had been otherwise. He seems in good spirits despite the treatments, and we are hopeful that we will be able to send off his package to us shortly. He insists he is able to get the manuscripts as well as the map and other items, so we shall see if he can manage it. Reginald and I made initial surveys at the south side of the river yesterday, having driven out to Wyalusing to inspect the mounds from a lookout near Shorger's Pigeon. Reggie loves that statue, and takes great pains to point out to me the inscription at its base. I am fortunate to have such a hearty friend. Without him, I do not think I would have the strength to continue this type of mythic detective work. I find I am flagging more and more the further we get into these mysteries. Perhaps the package from LTD will revive my energy. To be sure, the recent hysteria that is sweeping the country is connected to whatever lurks inside those mounds. We are both sure of it." Grant flipped back to the front page with the inscription, then pulled up a map on his phone to zero in on the location of Sauk Prairie. He wondered for a moment, then worked both thumbs over the phone to type a message to a person he knew could help in his own particular mission, a person who was also just as handy and composed, although perhaps not as talkative. "Hey," Grant texted, "you want to guide me down a river? Leaving in 48 hours. Grant felt relief at sending the message. If anyone could help him, it would be Ronnie Durham. Chapter 4. It was another 24 hours before Grant left, and another 3 hours after that until he arrived in Castle Rock. He had thought of taking Highway 12 through Arthur Derry's hometown of Sauk City, but decided against it. There was a lot of construction on the old state highway since it led right to the Wisconsin Dells. The Dells were a collection of strange and ancient rock formations carved out by the river over the eons and featured all sorts of kitsch and commercial attractions. He thought the interstate would be faster, but instead he ran into some more construction just north of Madison. He sat in his car crawling northbound and pieced together what he'd learned about Arthur Derry. From what Cassie had told him, her great-uncle was an outcast, but not because he was a drunk. The family had plenty of those. It was Derry's intellectual ambitions as an author and editor that set him apart. He published a local newspaper out of his rambling, Gothic-styled house by the river in Sauk City, printing stories of local happenings, school events, marriages, deaths, and black-and-white accounts of the undulating histories of the lower Wisconsin River Delta. He was one of those area's few attorneys and had a small publishing label he developed later in life that focused on science fiction and tales of the weird. He was a fixture in the town, and Cassie had vague memories of her father telling stories of how the family didn't quite know what to do with Uncle Arthur. He disappeared when he was about 60, not too much older than Grant felt he was now. One name stood out and was abbreviated in Derry's journal as LTD. A cursory internet search didn't result in much, but after some more digging, Grant discovered that this was an acronym for Lionel Thaddeus Devereaux, an obscure 1940s writer of sci-fi and horror short stories. Derry and his good pal Reginald Sykes were apparently convinced of Lionel Devereaux's genius and had thrown together their funds to start a publishing effort to catalog and preserve his works. Grant couldn't find much on Devereaux, save for some outdated postings on eBay for a couple of beat-up copies of a single-volume short story collection of macabre tales. The cover featured a distant river trailing into a black goo, with strange bird-like creatures drifting through a miasma that partially obscured a grotesque figure looming over the background. Grant had smiled at the cover's ham-handed pulp, but as he sat in his car, something turned over in his gut. It felt like there was genius operating inside the weirdness, but what was it? Eventually, he emerged from traffic and picked up speed past a set of dilapidated factories and new, more efficient-looking business parks. Gaudy signs that lined the highway advertising Ho-Chunk Casino sped by in a blur, and after another hour or so, he pulled into the gravel driveway of a bar he'd arranged to meet his old college buddy, Ronnie Durham. Ronnie was a man able to keep himself fully amused with his own inventions, and now he lived alone in a confirmed status of an eccentric bachelorhood. Ronnie was a born tinker with a capacity for lockpicking, hot wiring, and general artistic mayhem. More than anything, Grant envied Ronnie's ability to remain silent, composed, and secretly happy, despite a past that was equally as dysfunctional as his own. He snapped shut the car door and turned to enter the bar. The Happy Crappy was a wonderful place. He'd been here before during college road trips and appreciated its lack of pretension and deliberate kitsch. It was like a lot of Wisconsin lakeside marina bars, fake nets, ship wheels, and beat-up wooden bar tops facing onto a harborside patio that hosted fish boils and rented shacks for ice fishing out on the lake. Still, he couldn't help but feel out of place. Being born and raised on the south side of Milwaukee had made him an outsider to this rural sensibility, and the ongoing hostility between the urban masses and the rest of the state had always been part of his experience. Most of the houses around Castle Rock Lake were owned by city-dwelling weekenders who flocked to small lakeside towns all throughout the state, and he always felt a little less secure whenever he ventured outside of Milwaukee County. Not that he had much to worry about. He was as much of a European Catholic as most of the state, but he'd been to enough union meetings in Waukesha to understand that surrounding the Happy Crappy was an inherited distrust of the outsider. Nonetheless, it was the best place around to get a beer and watch the sunset before heading home. And so the bar was full of locals and vacationers when Grant made his way through the evening crowd. He'd just gotten his first beer when he got a buzz from a text reaching his phone. "Turn around and raise your hand." Grant did as instructed, and from across the bar he made out a man about his height with a wiry build and freshly buzzed hair. A large grin soon plastered itself across his face as he presented himself to Grant. For a guy that Grant hadn't seen in 5 years, Ronnie Durham still smiled like he knew all of his secrets. "How was the drive?" asked Grant, as Ronnie hoisted himself onto a bar stool. "Janesville keeps getting dumpier by the year." He knew what he meant. Up Interstate 90 from Chicago was a string of manufacturing towns hit hard by job losses in the 90s, and none of them had made much of a recovery yet. He'd spent time in Rockford, Beloit, and Janesville when working on a state Senate campaign for a woman who eventually went on to get shellacked by an incumbent Republican who ran a pest control business out of his basement. "Mom?" Grant had a set series of polite questions that he used as guide rails for initiating conversations. "She should be here any minute," said Ronnie. Suddenly, the bar quieted, and Grant turned to see the front door open again. This time, a figure in black leather and dark wraparound sunglasses filled the door frame. The man had long, slick black hair streaked with silver that hung down past his neck. The fading light reflecting off the lake seemed to surround him with fire, and when he fully entered the bar, the overhead lights revealed the chiseled features of an American Indian man with a stocky build and a jaw that looked like it was made out of rebar. "As a matter of fact, there's Lewis right now," said Ronnie, waving his hand at the older man. The man noticed and seemed to glide over to them with a confident stride. "Hello, Ron," said the man in a deeply resonant voice. He reminded Grant of the guys around the union halls who weren't in leadership but ran the shop floors and kept their own counsel. They had a gravitas that made Grant feel like he was standing next to a talking statue. "This is Grant. He's the one I told you about," said Ronnie, motioning over to Grant, who involuntarily stood up. Lewis just nodded gravely at him and looked at the bartender, who straightened up right away and came over. Lewis ordered a drink and stood with his hands inside the butter-soft black leather jacket. About 15 minutes later, Ronnie's mother showed up. Clara Dunham's first husband had passed away a number of years ago, and while Grant could tell there were scars on Ronnie from the loss, he seemed perfectly happy with how his mother's life turned out. Lewis worked for the Chippewas, running casinos around Mole Lake, and so Grant wasn't surprised when after they settled up after another round and stepped outside to head back to his mother's cottage, Lewis had pulled around in a 1965 Cadillac Coupe de Ville convertible that was as long and black and shiny as his hair. "We'll see you back at the house, guys," said Clara cheerily, laughing as Lewis fired up 8 cylinders and rode the caddy out of the lot. Ronnie piled into the front seat with Grant, and luckily the motor of the little Honda turned over correctly, and Grant was able to pull out a few minutes later and turn onto State Highway 80 and headed north. The sun had almost dipped behind the maples that lined the farm fields, and the familiar melancholy of a mourned summer brought their colors out more sharply. Grant rolled down the windows, and he and Ronnie passed the time catching up with one another. 10 minutes went by, and they passed a dilapidated 99-cent store just outside Nacida. Just past it was one of the old Danish cemeteries that dotted the area, one of the many peoples rooted in pantheistic nature religions that left continental Christianity to create their own traditions, nurturing them through the short, hot summers and long, tedious winters of the Great Lakes. Conventional wisdom draws lines connecting these tribal communities to Wisconsin's claim to being the birthplace of America's modern labor and socialist movements. Grant thought this idea had some merit since everyone he knew really did love a good fish fry. Suddenly, Ronnie pointed at a figure walking up the side of the road about a couple hundred yards ahead. The figure turned towards them and stopped, a skinny black lump standing stiffly on the roadside. "Pull over and see if this old guy needs something," said Ronnie. Grant clicked his tongue but choked it back. Ronnie was right. He should help the old guy. He slowed down and could see the man was indeed extremely old and was wearing a heavy black wool suit in what was still a pretty warm evening. Grant pulled over the little Honda and saw transparent beads of sweat pouring out of the man's luminescent white skin and a beat-up yellow handkerchief clutched in a gnarled and veined hand extending out from the jet-black suit. "Do you need a ride?" said Ronnie. The old man turned his head slowly, revealing watery blue eyes so light they seemed silver when framed against the red rims of his eyelids. He looked forlornly at the ground and remained silent. "We're going down a little past Highway 27 and making a right. Could we drop you there?" The old man shuffled his feet and seemed to nod. Ronnie looked over at Grant, who shrugged his shoulders and depressed the automatic unlock on the doors. Ronnie reached around behind his seat and worked the lever on the rear passenger door and popped it open. The old man shuffled to his left and managed to slowly climb in the back seat. Grant turned around in his seat and checked out the heavy wool suit. It was a throwback cut with brocade lining the lapel in a deep, almost purplish sheen. There were long stains along the right-hand side extending down to his waist, and the pants had bits of caked mud and grass stuck to the hems that covered the sturdy, cracked leather shoes. The whole getup seemed to emanate an earthy camphor smell that made Grant wince. He and Ronnie looked at each other again, and both wore an expression of mixing confusion, wonder, and a slight bit of fear. Grant brought the car back onto the highway, and in another few minutes saw the turnoff for Highway 27. He flicked on his turn signal and slowly brought the little Honda to a stop. The old man hadn't said anything the entire drive, and the few times that he or Ronnie managed to look back, the old man simply stared down at his shoes. Or was it at his hands that folded the faded yellow handkerchief over and over again? When the car stopped, the two could hear his labored breathing, and in a moment the door popped open and the old man managed to haul himself out of the car. Grant looked over his shoulder again, and Ronnie stuck his head out of the window. Together, they saw the man shuffle off wordlessly down the shoulder back towards the intersection. After a moment, Grant dropped the car back into gear and pulled out onto the road. "That was weird," muttered Ronnie. Grant wondered about the dark stain in black brocade, which seemed out of another time and obviously not cleaned in years. He reached up to adjust the rearview mirror and then felt a cold terror shoot up through his chest as he caught a glimpse of what was behind him. He brought the Honda to a screeching halt and threw the car in park, unhitching his seatbelt and throwing open the door. He clambered out of the Honda and stood motionless on the pavement while staring back down the road. "What happened?" said Ronnie, who had twisted around in his seat and followed Grant's gaze down the road. He only saw an empty stretch of highway now, flat on both sides without trees or cover for at least 25 yards on either side. He got out of the car and walked a few steps past Grant to look out over the road, but there was only an empty stretch of asphalt.
"Holy Christ!" whispered Ronnie.
Grant scanned the horizon. How could this be? They only dropped him off about 30 seconds ago. Grant and Ronnie ran down the highway to the intersection, but the same straight lines and empty fields presented themselves at every angle. The old man had simply vanished. For a good while, the only sounds were the slowly rising buzz of crickets in the fields arming up for the evening. The wind rose up suddenly, scattering leaves and old cut grass across the empty fields. After a moment, the two looked at each other uncomfortably and then turned to get back in the Honda. Hours later, the fire had crackled down to a glowing bed of coals, and the night sky had opened up to a starry patchwork of clouds and moonlight. The front that had blown in hadn't been much, but a steady breeze now brought a shiver to the little group huddled on Clara Dunham's back deck. When Grant and Ronnie finished telling their story of the old man, a silence settled down, and Grant and Ronnie found themselves looking at Lewis, who sat nursing a beer, imperturbable in a beat-up plastic Adirondack chair. After a moment, he sighed and poked at the fire with a broken-off rake handle.
"Yep, lots of dead white people around here,"
Ronnie snorted. His mom had done missionary work with the Dakota Sioux before meeting his dad, a USAF recruiter out of a station in Wilmington. He had spent a lot of time shuffling between reservation life and air bases, and Grant figured the two provided the foundation for the peculiarities of Ronnie's outlook on life, or at least his ability to keep his mouth shut for an extended period of time.
"There are a couple places like that around here. Was it right by the cemetery?" asked Clara.
Ronnie and Grant nodded.
"Well, that makes sense then," she said, snuggling closer to Lewis, who smiled and patted her hand with his.
"Yes. Here there is movement. Lots of unrest," said Lewis. "As an Indian, I can tell you that it doesn't surprise me in the least," Lewis said, with a grin creeping over his face.
"What's so funny?" asked Grant.
"Where are you two going tomorrow? Down to the river to where exactly?" said Lewis, looking at the fire.
"I'm supposed to write something about canoeing on the river for a couple days, but since I've never actually done that before, I suppose anywhere will do," said Grant.
Lewis was quiet again, then cleared his throat.
"You'd be right to get out before you get down to Boscobel. River opens up there into some very different country," he said.
"What does that mean?"
"The whole stretch from up here down to Sauk City is fine, but south of that towards the Big River lately there's been a lot of strange things going on. Not that it's ever been that quiet along there."
"Oh, Lewis, now you're just trying to scare him," said Clara.
"Well, geez, that's great," grumbled Grant, fumbling around the deck for his beer.
"It's been like that for a long time, though, right, Lewis?" said Ronnie quietly.
"Yes, it has."
Lewis shifted his weight in his chair and grinned again.
"Leave it to the old Indian to tell the stories of the ancient land, but as far back as my people remember, Unteki, the great serpent, lived at the end of the Meskousing, where the Dakota fought the filthy Ojibwe and the Algonquin invaders. Before that, there were still more men, some say the original men, who came from beyond the horizon that even Unteki had never known. They built the mounds on top of the riverbanks of the Minas do Tecar and then disappeared inside them, never to return."
"What's that, then? The Mississippi?" asked Grant, shifting in his lawn chair to avoid a stream of beer that accidentally spilled into his crotch.
"That's the Chippewa name. I'm using the original Sioux name," said Lewis.
"Oh, yeah, right," said Grant, now standing and brushing off beer onto the grass.
Lewis sighed. "Something like that anyway," he said, now lifting himself out of his chair. "Anybody need another beer?"
Well, I wouldn't mind another, if you're offering, said Grant. They heard Lewis let out a little laugh as he was already shuffling back to the house. Grant sat back down and kicked his feet out towards the fire. Getting cold already, it seems like, he said. Maybe we should get out earlier, Ronnie. What do you think? Well, how long are you supposed to go? Said Ronnie. Beats me. The editor only said to get enough material for a feature, so I thought we'd do an Indian thing or some sort of historical tour, or we could just map out the best places to pull over and buy more beer. Lewis had returned and handed Grant another beer. They continued to chat throughout the evening until the overhead stars seemed closer and the dark appeared complete. Soon after, they extinguished the fire and went back inside to bed down for the night. Grant adjusted his pillow on the pull-out couch in the small front room of the house. He could hear Ronnie already snoring in the guest bedroom down the hallway, while in the master bedroom slept Clara and Lewis. He was alone in a quiet house, and through the window he could see the lights of Highway 27 bridge twinkling far across the lake. Tomorrow morning they'd get up early and eat a quick breakfast and then head out onto the water. Grant hoped the trip would be a peaceful one, as he basically dropped everything on the campaign in order to go. The floor lamp next to him cast a warm yellow glow onto the bed sheets, and the bar of the fold-out crossed squarely underneath his shoulder blades. He twisted his body to sleep more horizontally and found himself staring down at his backpack, which contained the only clothes and supplies he had brought with him. Ronnie had already gotten most of the food, and the plan was to float for a while and find put-ins to hike into nearby towns to get supplies. It was a fairly busy river in the summer, and while it was likely to have thinned out in the fall, there were still plenty of takeouts lying in the river banks. By Sauk City, he figured he'd have enough material to get out and call one of the local canoeing rental outfits to pick them up and take them back to the Crappy, where they could drop the boat and get a ride back to the house. In an attempt at preventive self-care, he dug through his backpack to find a bottle of ibuprofen, and his hands fumbled through a change of clothes before running across the smooth leather cover of the journal. He thought for a moment, and then brought it out onto his lap. In the lamplight, the cover was a dull gold, and he flipped back pages to a recent entry. He read until sleep forced him to turn off the light and eventually succumbed to a set of fitful dreams. Chapter 5. The next morning, Grant awoke to the smell of bacon and a murmuring discussion in the kitchen. He pulled on his shorts from the previous day and dug a clean t-shirt out of his backpack before padding out to join the group. Lewis and Clara were huddled around a pot of coffee and buttering freshly toasted bread. Grant maneuvered around them and nodded to Ronnie, who was eating an apple. He put together a cup of coffee with milk and then sat down. "Sleep okay?" asked Lewis, looking at him with amusement. Grant nodded, although sleep was still something he wanted to do. "When are you guys heading out?" Grant looked up at Ronnie. He had firmly placed him in the position of leader for this voyage until he had gotten enough material to fill out his assignment, and then Grant figured he would call everything off and they'd get out of the river. "We're ready right now," said Ronnie. "Well, I need to finish this first," said Grant, motioning to his mug, "and then I should probably shower." About an hour later, Grant was dressed and finished up a final email to Corinne going over important details for the upcoming Harley-Davidson event. He double-checked the phone charger in his bag, although he supposed there wouldn't be any place to plug in. The brutal fundamentals of river life were slowly making themselves apparent to Grant, so that by the time he adjusted his brewer's cap and began to make his way to the water's edge, he was consoling himself that this would all be over soon. The Wisconsin River is one of the hardest-working rivers in the country, and there would be several bridges and dams they would be running into, requiring them to take their fully loaded canoe up and over embankments to a new put-in location further down the river. Ronnie had constructed a small carriage to help move the boat, but to Grant it just looked like a beefed-up lawn seed spreader. They loaded the boat with their gear, tent bag, personal bags, firewood, another crate with utensils for cooking, an axe, paddles, life jackets, and a long pole made of PVC that Ronnie had fashioned into a didgeridoo, a resonant wind instrument used by Aboriginal Australians. There was an ice chest Ronnie had brought up from Chicago that sat in the exact center of the boat to promote stability, and inside was an assortment of fruit, chips, a pack of hot dogs with buns, and a 12-pack of Country Time lemonade, which was apparently an absolute requirement for Ronnie's participation. Grant immediately recognized he had brought too much of the wrong stuff. He had no sleeping bag, which may or may not have been a good idea given the turning of the seasons. He did, however, bring a ratty comforter left over from college, and he noticed that it had swollen his threadbare Jansport backpack into a giant purplish boil. Ronnie's pack was better proportioned. His would leave him plenty of room to stretch his legs out. The carriage managed gracefully enough, but just as they arrived at the river's edge, there was a sharp crack. The rig had been crushed into the muck of the river bank and had given itself up for dead. Grant cursed when he realized that from now on they would be humping this canoe and everything in it over any embankments by hand. Nonetheless, the boat had made it to the water, and it was ready to accept passengers. Ronnie expertly climbed in the back of the canoe and sat down to face Grant. "Okay, now, just get in one leg at a time," he slowly enunciated. Grant was hoping to avoid sinking into the muck himself, but was unsure about where to step. He decided that the inside of the canoe was the general target, so he stretched out his right leg and planted it in the boat. Suddenly, the canoe started to roll beneath him, and he pinwheeled his arms frantically. "Don't move around!" yelled Ronnie. Grant instinctively lowered his body and grabbed both the gunwales to steady himself, and came to sit in the front seat facing towards the house, where he caught a glimpse of Lewis standing placidly with his cup of coffee and slowly shaking his head. "Okay, you ready, Captain Kangaroo?" said Ronnie with tangible frustration. Grant dug his paddle into the muck of the riverbank and pushed off from the shore with his life jacket riding up his back and causing his hat to tip forward down over his eyes. He and Ronnie managed a few awkward strokes until the canoe gained momentum, and a moment later Grant twisted his head to peer over his shoulder at the slowly receding shoreline. Soon they drifted around a bend, and the house had disappeared completely. They had launched at last. "Where's the first dam?" asked Grant. "Up at the end of the lake," said Ronnie. "We'll have to get out a little bit before and pull the boat up, but I don't think that's far from the put-in on the other side." Grant stopped paddling and let the oar rest on his lap while he straightened his cap. He hoped he was right about needing this break. While it was comforting to know that Corinne was twice as capable and motivated as himself, Grant was still worried about dropping the campaign for a week and losing the gig. Cunningham was doing okay, but everyone on the campaign knew that he had an affinity for action bars, Milwaukee slang for cocaine joints, and a few times already the stress of campaigning required a staffer to escort him back to Whitefish Bay. However, it was a beautiful Monday, and the fall sky had a lingering crispness to it that made Grant think about football and bratwurst. After being surrounded by the dark circumstances of the last few years, he had figured he'd never get to enjoy this kind of Wisconsin autumn again. He might not be an accomplished trekker, but he was glad he could still recognize the value of sitting quietly in a boat. He heard rustling behind him and turned to see Ronnie digging in the ice cooler. He had neatly arranged his life jacket as a backrest, while Grant had ended up settling for sitting on his like an overstuffed plastic cushion. He watched Ronnie extract another apple, along with a dripping wet and yellow-white can of Country Time lemonade. Ronnie took a bite out of the apple and then snapped back the tab. He munched thoughtfully, then swallowed the bite down with a guzzle of lemonade. "You really think that old guy was a ghost?" asked Grant. "Oh yeah," said Ronnie. "There are ghosts all over this place. Think about all the crazy people that came through here over the years, settlers and pioneers and army types, all battling it out. That kind of stuff always stays with the land." "I had no idea you were a druid," Ronnie snorted. "Well, it doesn't surprise me that we saw a ghost right by a graveyard." "Did you see the blood all over his sleeves?" "Yeah, freaky," said Ronnie flatly, now digging in the cooler again. He produced another Country Time and tossed it over to Grant. "Here, drink this," he said. "We have a long stretch today." "Well, how far until that dam again?" asked Grant, as he popped the can top and took a swig of the viscous yellow soda. "Probably be there in a couple hours, as long as the wind doesn't kick up. Paddling on a lake in wind is no bueno," said Ronnie, putting his can down on the canoe bottom and picking up his paddle to maneuver the boat carefully around the log jam. They paddled in silence, and Grant became keenly aware of the sun climbing higher. The river's early morning mist had thinned out, and he could see a small cottage's... They paddled in silence, and Grant became keenly aware of the sun climbing higher. The river's early morning mist had thinned out, and he could see small cottages lining the lakeshore on the far side of the lake. Soon a wind began to blow against his face. Grant noticed the water had become choppy with small waves that lapped against the sides of the canoe. "Ah, crap," muttered Ronnie audibly. "Now we're fucked." The wind did pick up, and together they battled through gusts that would switch from pushing them towards the shore to backwards as it came full into their faces. They rounded a bend and found themselves in a lee, which allowed them to catch their breath and pull up their paddles. Far down the lakefront, Grant could see a long and dark gray line extending from left to right across the water. "Is that the dam?" said Grant through labored breath. "Yeah," said Ronnie, "but let's hang out here for a bit." "Fine with me," said Grant. now digging in his bag for his cell phone. He pulled it out and held it up to the sky, searching for a signal, but after a minute of waiting, he sighed and put it back into his bag. "You expecting to hear about something?" asked Ronnie. "Actually, no," said Grant. "I don't even know why I bothered to look." "It's a hard habit to break, huh?" "I was hoping that getting back to nature would help me relax. Seemed like an easy gig, but now I'm not so sure," said Grant. Ronnie was looking at him with a traditional inscrutable boredom. "You always this busy?" "Nah, just trying to juggle a bunch of things, I guess." Grant reached down and stared at the aluminum can held between his feet on the bottom of the canoe.
"Well, how's the love life, then?" said Ronnie.
Grant chuckled and drained the last of his country time down his throat before smacking his lips and leveling his eyes at Ronnie.
"Pretty shitty," he said. "Girlfriend died on me? I didn't tell you that?"
"I got some text from you a while back that seemed to be getting at something like that, but I didn't know for sure," said Ronnie, looking at him with sad surprise.
"Yeah, well, I suppose she had it coming, or at least I did," said Grant flatly.
"How's that?"
"She always said she was going to die before me, and to be honest, there wasn't anything I could have done to stop her, not in any way that would have mattered."
Ronnie sighed and leaned back to chew on his apple.
"You know, your problem is you don't believe in a lost cause," he said after a moment.
"You're right, but what if that's what you do for a living?" said Grant.
Ronnie was silent. Grant tossed his empty can in the canoe. The sudden rush of the syrupy drink was already giving him a headache.
"I know we haven't seen each other in a long time, but I thought about you right away when I got this writing, Greg," said Grant.
"Oh, yeah?"
"Not because you're any kind of Admiral Peary. I just figured I could handle being in a boat with you more than anyone else, and I know for damn sure I wouldn't want to be alone out here," said Grant.
"Didn't you ever do Boy Scouts or something?"
"Nah," said Grant. "The only paramilitary training I ever got was going to union meetings where I learned to smoke a kielbasa and resist arrest."
"You still covering them for the paper?" said Ronnie.
"Nope. The paper gig ended a while ago, mostly due to my own contretemps with my manager and the fact that unions in this state have had their guts ripped out over the last couple years. To tell you the truth, I was glad I got fired. I couldn't take seeing what happened to these guys after the plant shuts down. Between their drinking and my shitty paycheck, I started to think I was at the end of the world."
"So now it's 100% politics?"
"Yep," said Grant, digging in the cooler again. "Although my win streak hasn't been so great with that either. It's a good thing I don't bet on horses." They continued to paddle close to the shoreline to avoid the wind, and soon Grant could clearly make out a long pile of rocks and rebar that made up the bulk of the upcoming dam. Beyond, Grant could see the river pick back up and run into the horizon. They got a bit closer and started to look for where exactly they would take out the canoe. Grant turned around and saw Ronnie peering through a set of binoculars.
"Where'd you get those?" marveled Grant.
"There's a guy fishing over there by a trail. I don't see anything else," said Ronnie.
"How are we going to get the boat out of there? It's just a big pile of rocks."
"I guess we get closer and find out," said Ronnie, placing the binoculars back into a small black carrying case. They worked the boat closer to the dam head, and soon Grant saw a large man in a bright yellow t-shirt and trucker hat gracefully casting and then slowly reeling back in a fishing line. His enormous bulk hung over a belt that cinched beat-up blue jeans around his waist. His face and arms were a dull brick red from the sun, and his eyes were obscured behind a large pair of reflective sunglasses. Ronnie gave him a small wave, and Grant could see that his shirt was emblazoned with the words, "Boilermakers Local 107. He vaguely recognized the chapter, but couldn't quite place it. He decided he was slightly afraid of the guy. When they got closer to shore, they could see there was a small footpath that led down from the top of the dam to the water.
"Is this the landing?" shouted Ronnie to the man, who simply nodded. "Is there any other one around here that's not so steep?"
The man shook his head slowly in the negative.
"Oh, well, I guess we got to use this one," said Ronnie, digging his paddle back into the muck of the lake bottom.
Grant struck his paddle out and pulled hard into the bank, feeling the boat pick up speed as Ronnie pointed it towards the small defile. They crashed into the embankment with a loud thud, and Grant was able to reach out and grab hold of some rocks to stabilize the canoe. He got out and attempted to pull the boat up under the embankment, but the rocks didn't give his feet much purchase.
"Hold on, bring me around to the side," said Ronnie.
Grant pulled on the side of the boat, and Ronnie brought the canoe parallel, where he was able to stick out a leg and hoist himself out of the canoe. It wobbled precipitously for a moment until Ronnie put both feet on shore.
"Now what?" said Grant, sweat pouring down his temples as the noonday sun opened up its full power on the lake below.
They surveyed the embankment and didn't see any other option. They'd have to drag the canoe up the incline and pull it across the road to put it back in the river below.
"Well, let's go check it out up top," said Ronnie, already clambering up the large rocks to the road above. Grant carefully picked his way up behind him, cursing to himself as he burnt his fingers on the edges of rocks made hot by the sun. They reached the top and saw there was at least 100 yards until a suitable put-in was available below the dam. "Well, we should pull all the shit out of the boat," said Ronnie, turning back to the lake. Grant felt his stomach lurch at the amount of effort he'd have to put in to get all of their things, plus the boat, to the river on the other side of the dam. However, they came over the embankment to see the giant man put down his pole and grab the gunwales of the little boat. With a single movement, he yanked the canoe out of the water and brought it smoothly up the embankment. Ronnie and Grant instinctively latched on and pulled it the rest of the way up onto the road. The man turned around and made his way back down to the lakeside. Grant watched as he extracted a long handkerchief from his back pocket and mopped his brow, then picked up his rod and cast out again, as if nothing much had happened. "Thank you," offered Grant weakly, but the man didn't turn around, instead raising his hand in silent acknowledgement. Ronnie and Grant dragged the boat over to the opposite side of the road and began to unpack all the items they had carefully arranged prior to getting into the water. Eventually, they managed to transfer everything down to the riverbank. Here, the Wisconsin regained its traditional shape as a wide, shallow, and sandy-bottom river that would only be dammed up one more time prior to joining up with the Mississippi. The two of them stood at opposite ends of the canoe and carried the empty boat down to the water's edge. After refitting the boat with their things, they were back in the water and gently paddling out into the middle of the stream, pointed south and westward towards the riverlands below. Now the sun had reached its zenith, and it began to drift off down towards the horizon. The river still ran south, and as the sun began to set, Grant found himself on his fourth country time. He wondered what the carbolic acid might be doing to his insides, but figured it wouldn't be any worse than what he'd already been putting down there. It occurred to him that maybe this chemical wash of his guts could help his liver out. There were mysteries to these types of old concoctions still on the shelves. He drained the can and reached back for another. "Take it easy, champ," said Ronnie, now half naked and wrapping his shirt around his head in a crude turban. "We need to ration this out." "Where's the next town?" "I was thinking about pulling over in the Dells," Ronnie said. "We should find a place to take out there since the river is pretty close to downtown." "Well, south by southwest then, Mr. Fletcher," said Grant. "I'll be taking a nap on the poop deck." Grant cracked open the can and leaned back on the makeshift litter he finally had been able to install on top of the pack stowed in the bottom of the canoe. He dozed in the sunlight, occasionally thinking about oncoming sunburn, but lulled by the rhythm of Ronnie's steady paddling. He didn't think he had actually seen anything worth writing about yet, unless you count the ghost up by Castle Rock, but he wasn't sure that would qualify as outdoor recreation for the magazine. His thoughts drifted to the man they'd seen on the embankment with the yellow shirt, and a sudden recognition made him sit upright. He remembered Boilermakers 107 as part of the group that marched in Milwaukee right around the time his dad got killed. They were strong then, with solid connections to other chapters in Illinois and Indiana, but over the years had pretty much folded from lack of membership. Suddenly his pack shifted underneath him, and he came down hard on his elbow, spilling the yellow lemonade around his bare feet. He cursed and picked up his backpack to shake the wet from the bottom when the top flipped back to reveal Derry's journal. He found a dry spot on top of a cooler and pulled out the weathered book to lay it in the sunlight. He flipped past the earlier pages and came to where he'd left off the night before. "I got this journal from Cassie's stuff. It was from her uncle," volunteered Grant to Ronnie, who was silently guiding the canoe under some willow boughs lining the riverside. "Pretty freaky to read, but she never really told me much about him," said Grant. "Apparently her mom was his favorite relative. He lived in Sauk City, too. Is that near here?" "Yep," said Ronnie. "Sauk City's coming up right after the Dells. Probably we'll get to it tomorrow." Grant didn't respond, instead turning his attention to the diary, and after skimming the next few entries to himself, looked up at Ronnie. "This uncle, Arthur Derry? He was a neat dude. He apparently founded a whole company just to publish this one guy's work," said Grant. "Some weirdo sci-fi guy." "Who's that?" "Some guy named Lionel Thaddeus Devereaux. Ever heard of him?" "Sounds familiar. You should ask Lewis," said Ronnie. "He's all about that stuff." "Well, check this out. He's describing him here," Grant read from the journal. "We received the package today with the rest of Devereaux's letters and other written works. While it is beyond thrilling to have recovered this treasure, I now know that LTD died alone. To say his life spiraled downward would imply some sort of gradual loss and denouement, but in truth it appears his madness came on quickly and ate him whole. even in our last visit, while ostensibly a celebration of our partnership to publish his first volume of short stories, there was a hollow stare in his eyes, and by the time of our departure his bony fingers were playing at the edges of his face while his mouth worked over some terror in his mind. Nonetheless, we were now in possession of the entirety of his effects, such as they were. I had turned to Sykes, and he too looked in awe at the small brown package spilling its contents onto my writing desk. We wondered where following his path might lead, for if Devereaux had already been down it, what might it have in store for us? "Poor guy," said Ronnie, still methodically paddling downstream. "Sounds awfully lonely." "Yeah, well, get ready," said Grant. "At the rate you and I are going, we might want to shack up together before we forget how to go to the bathroom." Ronnie laughed as he paddled. "You make sure to let me know if that happens, because I am not holding your Johnson while you pee," said Ronnie. "Now help me out, or we won't get anywhere near the Dells before sundown."